Thank you. Well, my topic, political economy and market risk, you may recognize as the description of the talk from the posters which are up around the place, and the title, Risk Uncertainty in the Economy, you may recognize as the title of my talk from the website announcement. So I thought I'd better put both, just in case half of you came to hear one, half came to hear the other. I didn't want half of you to walk out right at the beginning because your topic wasn't there. I should say something about myself in terms of academic background, in that I'm an economist. I studied politics, philosophy, and economics originally here at Oxford, and have been both an applied economist and an academic economist, including in management and business schools. And as I'll explain in a minute, risk plays a very important part for economists and management and business schools in explaining the way the economy operates. But it's not entirely uncontroversial. I'll start off by saying something about Keynes, the great economist John Maynard Keynes, who's actually mostly known for other work, but actually he regarded risk and uncertainty as very important. And then say something about the 2007-8 global credit crunch and the role that risk played in that. Something about environmentalism. So I think in order to face up to the challenges of climate change, it is important to minimize, well, obviously, the risks of environmental catastrophe. But then I will stop to say, well, is that right that we just need to minimize risk and uncertainty? Isn't risk a good thing in order to encourage innovation? And then I'll go on to say something about trying to get more corporate diversity as a way of dealing with problems of risk, and then go on to talk about lessons and policy implications. I said that Keynes is better known for other things, and actually he's made a bit of a comeback. And he was the regarded as the main economist when I was studying it at Baylor in the 1970s. Obviously, he fell out of fashion with the rise of monetarism throughout the 80s and 90s, but he's made a bit of a comeback with the credit crunch, and actually 2009 was the first global recession in the sense that national income actually fell rather than rose. First global recession since the days that Keynes was writing in 1936. So Keynes is best known for his book he published in 1936 at the actual height of the Great Depression in the 30s, called The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money. And basically he was arguing that unemployment could persist, full employment wasn't automatic within a free market or capitalist economy. And you might think, well, sure, that's a pretty obvious thing to point out when you've had mass unemployment across the world for several years during the 1930s. But actually, economic orthodoxy then was still arguing that the economy would just automatically return to full employment. He argued it didn't, most fundamentally because of demand. If there wasn't the demand for goods and services, then firms wouldn't hire workers to provide those goods and services, so you would have unemployment. But a part of that story was linked up with risk and uncertainty, because an important component of demand is investment, and companies won't invest unless they have confidence that future demand will pick up, there will be demand for their goods and services once they're newly invested in factories start producing. So uncertainty played a big role for Keynes and risk and uncertainty. And the key distinction he built on, it was actually made by before him, was the distinction within economics between risk and uncertainty. And the distinction is that the risk is something you know for sure. So if you make a bet and you cost a toy to be heads or tails, you know the risk of losing your money is 50%. The risk of it not coming up heads is 50%. And there are all sorts of risks in the economy and society where you do know the probabilities beforehand and you can calculate them and insure against them with certainty. But Keynes argued, again he wasn't the first, that not all decisions are like that. There are many which you don't know the outcomes for sure. Big questions like, if he was around today, you know, will Greece still be in the euro in 2 months' time? Will war break out, or in today's age, more likely, in which country will war next break out? Those sort of questions are fundamentally uncertain, and we don't know the probabilities. Maybe it'll have some sort of guess, but they're fundamentally can't be calculated in the same way as tossing a coin and knowing that the chance of that coming up heads will be 50%. So that's the role Keynes saw: risk and uncertainty leading on to expectations, demand, and the importance of that in driving the economy. Fast forwarding to what happened leading up to the credit crunch, or maybe I should backtrack to Keynes for a minute, because in arguing how you tackle the Great Depression that he was writing in the 1930s, and how you try to prevent a return to that, when he was helping to devise the post-World War II international settlement, he actually saw developing institutions to minimise risks and uncertainties as being fundamental to making the economy work productively, including on a global scale. So he tried to actually get much more international regulation, much stronger international institutions, the IMF, World Bank, and so on, than he actually managed to achieve. But the institutions that he did help set up, the World Bank, fixed currencies, International Monetary Fund, and so on, did actually oversee the most successful period of economic growth under capitalism ever during the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s. But since he fell out of favour, then, as we know, during the 1980s and 1990s, much of that regulation was pared back, fixed exchange rates were abandoned, and so on. And what I think has largely gone uncommented on, or hasn't at least received the attention it deserves, is precisely the topic of tonight's discussion about risk and uncertainty, because there's been a huge growth in risk and uncertainty created during the 1990s and then, well, the past 20 years or so. And that risk, that speculation, those gambles, basically paid off for a lot of people during the 1990s, the last 20 years. A lot of people, companies got very rich, but they basically, one way of explaining it is they failed, or enough of those gambles failed in 2007-08 for the whole thing to come crashing down. And that's what I've summarized there: the 30 years of privatization, deregulation, demutualization, promotion of shareholder value concept, allowing these financial markets to dominate, huge increase in financial speculation. Now, what the orthodoxy during the time was saying was, well, to the extent that this was pointed out, that the world was being made a riskier place, the economies were being made riskier, was that, well, those risks could be covered, they could be insured against, and that indeed a huge amount of money, a growing proportion of the economy in Britain and America was made up by people doing precisely that, financial dealers who were insuring against these new risks that they were themselves creating. And I put that sort of mindset, I think, was epitomised globally by the role Goldman Sachs played in a couple of years ago in Greece before things got to their current state, where it was discovered that Goldman Sachs had been setting up the financial deals to keep the Greek economy afloat, but then on the side had secretly been betting that the Greek economy would collapse. But it is quite a striking example of insider dealing, making bets when you actually know the inside story. In this case, the fact that the books have been cooked, and so the economy was bound to collapse sooner or later. And of course, Goldman Sachs knew that books had been cooked because they had cooked them. So that was quite a dramatic example when that was exposed. And I would say within the UK, a similar story with the story of Northern Rock, which was at the time of the 2007 credit crunch, became known, famous, or infamous globally because of the photos being put on the media around the world of people queuing up all night to get their money out of the bank in the morning, which was a picture which was quite common more than 100 years ago when banks were first being set up because people didn't really understand how it would work and really trust that the bank would have the money. So as soon as a rumour went round that maybe the bank wouldn't have enough money, everyone would rush to get their money out. And of course, by definition, that would bankrupt the bank. So regulations had to be introduced to try and ensure that banks retained enough money. The case of Northern Rock is particularly ironic because they had been a mutual building society owned just by their members to lend money to their members for the purchase of the house, but they were victim of that demutualisation trend in Britain, where most building societies, by one betrayed, were demutualised, turned into private banks, who then just joined in the frenzy of global speculation. And the rumour went round, which proved to be correct, they wouldn't have enough money to give back to the savers, who then queued up outside in the morning. Sure enough, there wasn't enough money there to pay them back. So coming on to my own research, this is one thing I've been looking at in the Oxford Centre for Mutual and Employer-Owned Business, based at Kellogg College, has produced this report making the case for Northern Rock to be remutualised. And indeed, the coalition agreement that formed the current UK government actually committed this government to greater corporate diversity in the financial services sector, including through the promotion of mutuals. Now, given that the only realistic way that could be done would be remutualising Northern Rock, that looked quite likely. Although actually now, I think the smart money is betting that they won't do it, and actually they'll just renege on the coalition agreement, unfortunately. I won't say anything more about the global credit crunch, because I said a lot in a lot of iTunes U podcasts, which, if you don't know, are all downloadable free of charge through University of Oxford. The University of Oxford, I think, has had 12 million, 18 million, at least 12 million downloads of their podcasts. The most popular, which I'm pleased to say, is Department of Continuing Education's ones on philosophy, Marion Talbot's one, which was number one globally for many weeks. I'm afraid Linda Yu is at Teddy Hall, and me and her only got to number three, third place globally, which was, we got to second place globally, which was frustrating not to get to number one, but when we were second place globally, we were keeping Barack Obama's inaugural speech in third place, which I thought was quite impressive. So this is, I think, what happened with the credit crunch, where they've just returned to business as normal, and we're in good enough shape to start making the same mistakes again. Which, despite the global credit crunch having created that global recession in 2009, the necessary measures haven't been taken, and we are still likely to slip back into a subsequent recession. Very briefly, on the environment, obviously there are huge uncertainties, and I would argue, and in a book which is on display in at the entrance, that what's needed is a lot more than just tinkering at the edges or tinkering with prices and taxes. I mean, prices and taxes are important, but just changing people's decisions at the margin isn't really enough. We do need complete behaviour change by companies, by managers, and that can be done, but it's a major step change, and it's that mindset which is needed by governments in Britain and around the world, through launching a major Green New Deal and other actions like that, which are required. The Oxford professor, David Hendry, has produced an amazing analysis of climate change and the annihilation of species on the globe going back millions of years. In fact, every time actually has been caused by climate change, the latest evidence shows. And he's criticises the Stern report on environmental change, which is very good in a number of ways, but the main criticism he makes of it is relevant to today's discussion about risk, because Nick Stern's report talks about the discount rate and us having to decide how much damage there might be in the future and what rate of discount we would apply to money we invest now compared to what difference it makes in the future. And David Hendry argues that's just completely the wrong way of looking at it. That's assuming that it's completely calculable, like flipping a dice and having risk, whereas what we're talking about is fundamental uncertainty and not really knowing what's going to happen. We know that there's huge danger than the ecological environmental disaster. And so we must act now rather than just contemplating at the margin. And in fact, I think that point was quite well made in a cartoon I tried to find, but couldn't, which is in the Financial Times a few months ago, where there were two Martians who had arrived on planet Earth and it was completely desolate. And one of them was saying to the other, "Oh dear, I guess they must have chosen the wrong discount rate." Now, I mean, I've been arguing that we'll agree with Keynes, that economists, politicians should try and reduce the amount of risk and uncertainty in the economy. But I thought it was important to acknowledge the counter-argument that maybe risk uncertainty is a good thing because it promotes innovation. After all, every time a company innovates, there's a risk it might not sell, the company might go bankrupt, and so on. And I'd say, yes, and that's certainly true, but it's completely different order of magnitude. It's good to promote individual innovations by companies, but one of the surest ways of encouraging that is actually to have confidence the economy is going to be growing into the future. So they aren't incompatible, the two arguments. I think the argument of Keynes is actually the one which creates the best conditions to encourage innovation. I mean, the counter view was put in some senses during the move against Keynes in the 1980s with the labour market deregulation, the idea that doing away with labour rights, encouraging hire and fire mentality would make companies more innovative. They could try something, if it didn't work, they could just sack a few workers and downsize and try something else. If that worked, they could expand and so on. And with a colleague, we looked at the companies which had taken advantage of labour market deregulation in Britain and put people onto short-term working or part-time working and so on, versus those companies that had just carried on regardless as before and hadn't taken advantage, to see if there was a statistical difference between them. And we suspected that there probably wouldn't, because you know, I was quite sceptical of that line of argument. We found actually there was a statistically significant difference between them, but it was the exact opposite of the one which would have supported the labour market deregulation policy making. Actually, the companies who took advantage of those sort of labour market deregulationary acts proved to be less innovative, less likely to innovate. And the innovative companies were the ones which hadn't taken advantage of that. On the contrary, when we then went and looked at what those companies had done, which the others hadn't, they'd actually invested in their workforce, in training, skills and so on. And ironically, as part of that, creating those sort of high commitment work systems, as they're known in management literature, had actually given, oftentimes, they'd actually given job guarantees, the exact opposite of labour market regulation, as part of that package. And I think once you start to think it through, it's not that surprising. I mean, if a worker thinks up a great way of doing away with their job, they're unlikely to pointed out to their supervisor, unless they have a good deal of confidence that the company will use that to good effect to retrain them and expand what the company does, rather than just abolishing the job and sacking them. I think this is quite a nice illustration of that sort of short-term thinking by boards of directors. The dog by being a consultant saying your profits are plunging, that's a problem. The problem won't be easily solved. That's a sign of the brains of the directors on competitor companies, average size of a beaver's brain, and your average size of your brain to this board of directors, to which the board of directors say, "So what should we do? Cut the training budget again," which is that sort of hire and fire labour market deregulatory approach, which actually doesn't lead to more innovation. So having argued that I think Keynes was right, that an important part of economic policy should be to try to introduce more stability and less risk and uncertainty. One way of doing that is having a greater diversity of corporate forms. If all your corporate forms are the same type, say shareholder-owned companies, and there's some shock to the system, and they all react in the same way, it's likely to be quite destabilizing for the economy. If you've got all sorts of different companies operating in different ways, then the negative impact on the economy would be that much less. And that comes back to the point I was making before about having a mutual building society sector of the financial services sector, having more cooperatives and corporate forms other than privately owned PLC companies. And that's argued in detail in another report that the centre did. And we've actually been commissioned now by the Building Societies Association to devise a measure of corporate diversity, because although the current coalition government is committed to making the financial services sector more corporately diverse, not only they're not doing anything about it, they're not even measuring it, so they wouldn't know if they had succeeded. Given they're not planning to succeed, maybe that's not so surprising, but anyway, that's what our research is currently trying to do. So, in terms of the lessons and conclusions, I'd say for economic theory, one way of describing it is that the economy isn't a machine where you can just pull a lever and something else will happen. And so crucially, you can't just insure against all uncertainties. Some things are just unknowable. And so they are just speculative gambles, not really calculable insurance policies. And in terms of economic policy, then all the sorts of items that Keynes referred to and himself devised, which you can think of in one way as just being buffers in the what will otherwise become quite easily out of control free market processes. So having I put sand in the wheel there. You may have seen in the papers talk about the Tobin tax, sometimes referred to as a Robin Hood tax, the idea of putting a small tax on every financial speculation or financial currency trade, which would raise billions of pounds globally. Bill Gates was quoted yesterday in the papers, I think, coming out in supporting it. And that's interesting because it's called the Tobin tax because it was first advocated by James Tobin, who's no longer with us, but he was a Nobel Prize winning economist. And interestingly, he didn't advocate it in order to raise lots of money to do good things like solve global poverty, which is what Bill Gates is interested in. He did it because it would make economic markets operate less efficiently. In other words, the problem he saw even then in the global economy is if economic markets work too efficiently, they will just become out of control. But actually, it's good to put sand in the wheels to slow them down, to make them operate less frenetically, I guess he would say. So automatic stabilizers refer to the fact that if the economy goes into recession, governments tend to spend more money on unemployment pay and so on, which tends to get the economy back up again. Sort of regulation that Keynes introduced, fair trade to encourage producers in the third world to actually create cooperatives to give themselves economic power in bargaining against multinationals, having the sort of corporate diversity I've been talking about, etc., etc. I could do a long list, but the one thing all these things have got in common is they introduce more stability to the system, make us less prone to risk and uncertainty, as opposed to just promoting speculation. Now, very, very finally, there's something called the Commission on Ownership has been set up, which the Oxford Centre on Mutual Employer-Owned Business I mentioned is doing the research for, which is looking at corporate ownership in Britain and how that could be improved, including trying to tackle the long-standing problem of British corporate decisions often being made on very short-term bases. It's chaired by Will Hutton, who at the time was chair of the Work Foundation. In fact, he's just come to Oxford, coincidentally, to be head of Hertford College. Sir Roger Carr is head of the CBI. Sylvia Jay is giving a talk next Thursday at Kellogg College. And I'm hopeful that the results of this commission, which will be published next year, will make the case for corporate ownership involving more stewardship to try to make sure that the assets of the company continue to operate successfully over time, hopefully generations, rather than just trying to speculate to make as much money in the short term as possible. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much indeed, Jonathan. We have time for one or two questions. Do you have any questions for Jonathan on market? Well, I've got one in terms of diversity was the underlying theme there. And Jocelyn Hughes at the back is a biodiversity specialist and talks about biodiversity. In housing market, we talk about diverse housing planning, etc., is the way forward. But in terms of the logic of capitalism, capital accumulation really fights against diversity, doesn't it? It looks to make efficiency, it looks to focus the forms of production, means of production. So in the mutual ownership schema, where diversity would seem to lead to profit, the logic of the capitalist market go against that. So what mechanisms would you put in? I mean, I guess it goes back to Keynes in some way, but surely there's an anti-logic, or the logic that acts against your diversity as being good and sustainable, if you will.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it does need regulation and government action to make sure that in the case of mutuals, the assets are locked in for the benefit of future members as well as just the current ones, the current members. And the reason that John Lewis, which you may know is owned by its employees, doesn't have any external shareholders, the reason that's managed to fight off any attempt to turn it into a private company and enrich the current owners is the trust which owns it on behalf of the current and future employees. So every time there's been an attempt to buy the company, they say, well, it might be a good deal for current employees who would get £10,000 each or whatever as a windfall, but not necessarily for the future employees. And that's why the mutual building societies managed to fight off that predatory approach from private banks for 100 years, because there was regulation in Britain, as there is in most other countries in the world, to lock in those assets for the benefit of future members as well as the current members. But what happened in the 80s is there was legislative changes to which opened them up to what came known as carpet baggers, so anyone could join the mutual, vote to demutualize it and get a windfall payment representing the value which had been built up by generations of previous owners. So yes, it does need, I mean, if the current coalition government is going, the only way it will achieve its the aims of that they commit themselves to in the coalition agreement of making the economy more corporate diverse is if they take legislative action to make that so.
Thanks very much. Yeah, Christine.
I was just wondering how you define the term innovation. Is the word innovation intended to encompass entrepreneurship or aspects of entrepreneurship?
Innovation generally defined to mean a new product or a new process, you know, sufficiently new, different from the previous one, so it's not just, you know, different colour or whatever. The sort of link with entrepreneurs is, I guess, an entrepreneur will generally be looking out for a new product or process as a way of making money, or conversely, you know, it may be that a new innovation would only be exploited if an entrepreneur comes along to exploit it. Although, having said that, most innovations are actually both come across and exploited by existing companies that introduce them themselves, and often by the patents up precisely to prevent the new innovation being exploited, because they're making a lot of money from the current ones. But it's a good question. I mean, I should have included a discussion of entrepreneurship when I said innovation, but because so the counter argument to everything I've said, the idea that having a loss of risk and uncertainty may be a good thing, links with this idea of entrepreneurship as well, give lots of opportunities for someone to step in, take a risk and make some money. That story always reminds me of the joke of the person who sees his old school friend driving by in a Rolls Royce and flags him down and says, well, what's with the Rolls Royce? And the person said, oh, I'm a millionaire. And I says, well, how on earth did that happen? He said, well, started a little bike shop in the shed, you know, repairing bikes in my back garden. That went quite successful. So I developed a little car repair shop under the arches. And then my uncle died and I inherited £1 million. There's an economist, Andrew, did a survey of successful entrepreneurs to see what the key determining factors were. I think it was done by Andrew Oswald, who's now a professor at Warwick and was at Oxford. And I imagine risk appetite was one of them, but I must admit, I remember the fact which came out as the most statistically significant factor determining successful entrepreneurs from others, and it was inheriting money. So, yes, I mean, innovation is sometimes linked with entrepreneurs, but often the other way around. Well, often the other way around as well. It's often existing companies which actually develop and exploit the innovations, and often entrepreneurs actually aren't particularly innovative.
But are able to calculate and take risks.
Mm. Yeah. We'll perhaps have time for one question. Is that okay? Then we'll move on to Nigel. If that's okay, we can bring the other questions in the end. Is that okay? So, yeah.
Yeah. If you look at other examples of where there have been schemes of preserving assets for future generations, such as medieval entails or inalienable land of churches and so on, eventually you come to a point where the assets congeal and you need to unfreeze them because they are no longer being productively useful, or they are actively become a problem. I mean, how do you create mechanisms in your processes which allow sort of orderly transfer of assets which are no longer useful? In a market economy, companies fail fairly rapidly. I mean, companies which were huge at the beginning of the 20th century, or even 50 years ago, if you look at a company like ICI, disappeared and been replaced by others. If you have a scheme such as mutual ownership, which preserves the assets continuously for future generations or future generations of workers, sooner or later, that is going to become a problem.
Yeah, well, every country deals with it, you know, slightly differently. First interesting point to make is that, you know, after, you know, well over 100 years of capitalism, I don't think there's a single capitalist country which has actually done away with cooperative mutuals. They all do have legislation to preserve the assets of co-ops and mutuals. Every single one. The only thing about Britain is they've switched hugely over the last 20 or 30 years to have a far more dominant role for the PLCs, which I think played a major part in the creating the credit crunch and the recession we're still suffering from. One point, though, is they all do allow mutual cooperatives to go bankrupt if they fail, if they're not doing a good job. But the point is the assets then have to be distributed to local charities and so on. People can't make personal financial gain from it.
I'm going to talk really about work I've been doing recently on risk management in the built environment. Concentrates on large-scale risks, both natural and man-made. In fact, the distinction between natural hazards and man-made hazards is quite blurred. Climate change is obviously the most obvious example. I'm not really going to talk about climate change. I'm going to talk about the impact of individual catastrophes. The word risk is an interesting word, especially from a business or economist's point of view, because risk has a direction. It can be a good risk as well as bad risk. So from a point of a property developer, you know, they would look at upside potential, which is a form of risk, as much as downside risk, which is the kind of risk we've already been talking about today. And when we're talking about catastrophes and hazards, we're talking about downside risk, we're talking about bad risks. My work's mostly in the context of cities. I'm interested in systems-based risks. And my current work started to look at the applications of complexity science to the management of risks. Complexity science is appropriate. It is complicated. And we live in a society which Ulrich Beck calls a risk society. He makes the point that risk is synonymous with the anticipation of catastrophe. It's not actually the catastrophe itself. And most risks don't materialise. I'm talking about this kind of hazard in the built environment, that they are anticipated, hopefully they're planned for, but largely they don't materialise. The difficulty is you don't know when a risk will materialise, you don't know where it will materialise. And Jonathan made the point, the distinction between uncertainty, unknowable, immeasurable, and risk, which can be calculated and managed. I'm not going to worry about that distinction. Just going to talk about risk in a slightly more generalised sense. But the distinction is very important when you're making risk mitigation plans, because uncertainty, things you can't really know or calculate, are the hardest problems to deal with. And these risks can be classified. There are various ways to draw up a taxonomy. Individual risk, which is a risk to an individual property or a building, not going to worry about that. Regional risk, the Indian earthquake tsunami in December 2004 is an example. It affected 14 different countries, probably more, but casualties were recorded in 14 different countries. And there are difficulties there because of the mechanisms of global governance. Planning for a risk like that, which is probably done on a local or national scale, is problematic in itself. Through to global risks, even if in this taxonomy, you could even have intergenerational risks, which we've talked a little bit about in context of these mutual companies. And these classifications can apply. These aren't dichotomous, they can apply at several levels at the same time. So anyone who suffered from a tsunami will have had individual risk to their own property and possessions and possibly their life, as well as national risk, global risk or regional risk. So I'm going to talk for a moment about global catastrophic risk. Not really the focus of what I want to cover, but it's quite important. It's loosely defined to mean a risk that might have potential to inflict serious damage to human well-being on a global scale. So it's a sort of alarming kind of risk. And there are quite a few examples of global catastrophic risk. Volcanic super eruptions, pandemic infection, comets, asteroid strikes, sometimes these are called cosmic hazards. Then there are man-made global catastrophic risks, a nuclear accident, out-of-control scientific experiments, colliders, war, worldwide tyranny, terrorism, bioterrorism. If you look at the literature on global catastrophic risks, nanotechnology, completely unknown what the consequences of some of these technical and innovative technologies would have. There are other global catastrophic risks. Economic collapse. Is Greece going to leave the euro? Is the euro going to collapse? And it's quite a long list. But most risks aren't global. Most risks are at a lower level than global, but they're still catastrophic. And they make up quite a long list. So I've put two groups of risk here, natural hazards and man-made hazards, because there's such a crossover between the two. Fire, forest fire, bushfire, you've seen these out-of-control fires raging on television. Well, often they're caused by arson. So that's a crossover, a blur of the boundary between the natural hazard and the man-made hazard. And many of the things that happen on the natural hazard side have knock-on effects. Nearly every catastrophic risk that arises causes a whole series of other problems. Transport system failure, supply chain failure maybe, power failures. So there's a cascading when one risk arises onto other risks. And even innocuous things, seemingly, that aren't going to affect us on a regional scale, have a bigger impact than expected. The volcano in Iceland, April 2010, all air traffic in Europe was grounded for 7 days. That's unprecedented. Serious economic consequences, both for the airlines and the businesses involved, but also for for travellers, businesses who aren't directly involved in the airline business, and some much more serious problems, dire consequences for people with different medical conditions, where travel, transportation of medicines could be important or even critical. So, let's just have a look here. Industrial accidents are an interesting and problematic one, and related to industrial sabotage, the Bhopal disaster, chemical plant disaster in India in December 1984, it's the world's worst industrial accident. 11,000 people are estimated to have died, both in 3,000 and 4,000 in the immediate aftermath, and the rest subsequently. Between 100,000 and 200,000 people have been injured or disabled by that disaster. And it's generally thought it's caused by industrial sabotage. So that's a... You might classify it as an industrial accident, but it's caused by something else, so a disgruntled employee. And there's another quite significant point about this kind of risk, and that is the spatial concentration of the impact, both on the built environment in that area and on the population in that area. And depending on where you are, you've got very few opportunities to relocate. So if between 100 and 200,000 people are estimated to have been permanently injured or disabled, and that's the size of a city of, in the UK, Newcastle. If you can imagine that kind of disaster, in fact it's hard to imagine that kind of disaster. And there's a lot of politics that comes into play. In the case of the Bhopal disaster, it's not generally acknowledged as industrial sabotage, although people in the sort of disaster and emergency community recognise that. Because of the settlement terms and compensation payments those affected, which came from Union Carbide, the Indian government have never acknowledged the actual cause of the accident. It's always blamed on problems at the plant, and let's not say there were no problems at the plant. The problem with Bhopal is an interesting one as well because of other factors. There's no existing catastrophe plan in place in 1984 for that plant. Hospitals didn't even know how to treat the kind of chemical injuries that would arise from that disaster. So it was a sort of watershed, really. It's inconceivable that you could have a plant of that size with that kind of impact and no assessment at all of the consequences. So catastrophic risks, not global catastrophic risks, annually cause tens of thousands of deaths, they cause billions of pounds worth of losses, and some of these losses you can insure against. That's certainly in Western economies, that's the main way to mitigate potential financial losses. But figures from the insurance industry, these are global figures, this isn't for a single company. In 2005, losses from catastrophe were reported at $230 billion. And out of that 230, 210 billion are from natural catastrophes, natural disasters. And in that particular year, 173 billion is due to Hurricane Katrina. So one single event took up 173 billion out of 210 billion worldwide losses. At the same year, Kashmir earthquake in Pakistan, the losses are about 5 billion, mostly uninsured. That earthquake killed 76,000 people. In New Orleans, death tolls obviously much less, but the value of the assets was so much higher, and that's the reason for the difference between 173 billion for Katrina and estimated 5 billion for an earthquake in Pakistan. There's a lot of reasons for that death toll. The building codes hadn't been, firstly, they probably hadn't been followed, but they only recently, in Pakistan had they been put into place, so older buildings wouldn't withstand an earthquake. If you take the case of the 1989 earthquake in San Francisco, it was a similar scale, similar magnitude. That was 7.6 magnitude. The earthquake in California was 6.9 magnitude, and a couple of hundred people died. Most of those died on a freeway, a two-tier freeway which collapsed, called the Cypress Freeway in Oakland. That had been strengthened for earthquake resistance, but they had failed to take account of the soil. It was built on marshland. That was an unusual accident. So in an industrial, advanced nation, earthquakes of a similar size have a very low death rate compared to Pakistan in that example. So that's some of the risks. Many of them can't be avoided. They have to be managed, and a large part of the management of these risks involves having a plan in place that is can be put into effect as far as possible to mitigate the problems if the disaster actually strikes. So this is a spiral model showing disaster risk management. In this side you've got post-disaster recovery, but on the other side you've got pre-disaster risk reduction phase. And it starts with a risk and vulnerability assessment, and then risk reduction, disaster preparedness, then you have the impact. So key point, this impact may not happen, and depending on, and probably won't, depends where you are. In the case of Hurricane Katrina, there was a 0.33% annual chance of a flood in New Orleans. So over 30 years, that's a 10% chance of a flood. So I'd say that's a likelihood. And yet they didn't strengthen the levees. When the storm surge hit, 53 levees were breached in New Orleans. So one approach would have been to strengthen the levees. Another approach would have been to have an effective evacuation plan, which they clearly didn't have. So having an adequate plan, introducing risk reduction measures, in that case it would be strengthening the levees or the defences, having a plan for evacuation, which is not always possible, depends on the kind of catastrophe you're going to experience, but in the case of Katrina, that they could have evacuated. And then you move into the post-disaster recovery phase, immediate relief, the emergency response, the transition phase and reconstruction. And you learn lessons from what happened in that disaster. So you move into the outer area where you're trying to have disaster prevention with sustainable development. So the important first step is this risk and vulnerability assessment. I'm not going to go into that in any great detail, but there are four risk assessment questions which you need to ask. The first one is what can happen, what can go wrong? So that's the scope. And the second one is what's the likelihood that it will happen, what's the probability? And that question may or may not be able to be answered, it depends on the problem. Third question, what's the cost if it does happen? And that's actually usually where the questions stop in the literature. But the other relevant question, I think is probably the most important one, is what does preventing it cost? Because the way to do this evaluation stage, risk and vulnerability assessment, is almost certainly cost-benefit analysis. That's the tool for the policy tool for analysing whether to take steps or not to take steps. Cost-benefit analysis is a sort of a topic in itself. It involves often, especially in this kind of disaster, making decisions about the value of a life. There's a substantial literature about the value of a life. But I think the thing I'd stress is that the assessment and management of risk, this phase of risk and vulnerability assessment, is a synthesis of several different things, an amalgamation, empirical and normative judgments, quantitative and qualitative judgments and objective and subjective. These things, it's about trade-offs. And from a public policy point of view, those trade-offs are complex, because there's a myriad of economic, organisational, institutional sectors who interact, and the thing as a whole can be viewed as a large-scale complex system. This Indian Ocean tsunami is a prime example of the problems with this kind of planning. Because policymakers pay too little attention to this kind of disaster for several reasons. It's got a low probability, but if it does occur, it creates enormous losses, a truly catastrophic consequence. In the case of the 2004 tsunami, I think there were 230,000 people died in 14 countries. The problem for policy is partly the political time frame. Politicians with limited terms of office will discount or ignore low probability events. This is saying statesmen think about the next generation, politicians think about the next election. So another factor is complexity in modern society. Systems of governance may not be in place to handle this kind of catastrophe. So it makes it difficult for officials to respond. Because there's quite a spectrum of risks against which cost-justified measures are warranted, but they can't easily respond to them because either of the political time frame or the complexity of the organisation, the institutional context, I'd say. The question I talked about earlier is this relationship, this blurring of the boundary between man-made and natural disasters. I'll spend a moment on the idea of a man-made natural disaster. Set aside the small matter of climate change, but let's have a look at a couple of short slides. So there's an earthquake in the Lancashire coast. We don't really get earthquakes in the UK, although as a matter of fact we do, but we don't get serious earthquakes. So in May, on BBC News, two small earthquakes, no casualties or damage. And just the other day, it was 2nd of November, it is found, and it was always suspected this was the case, that gas extraction off the coast, it's called fracking, triggered these two earthquakes. So that's potentially quite alarming. You can have earthquakes caused by man's activities. In this case, it's a very small problem. There are three main causes of earthquakes, and one of them is artificially induced earthquakes. And the most common example of that is called reservoir triggered seismicity. So it's for non-tectonic, not caused by the plates moving, or the usual reasons we imagine there being an earthquake. The US Geological Survey recognized 11% of earthquakes in stable continental regions are from non-tectonic origin. And the 2008 Sichuan earthquake, sometimes called the Great Earthquake in China, May 2008, it's a huge earthquake caused by a slip on a known fault. 68,000 people killed, 374,000 injured, 5 million people left homeless, and it's thought that that is triggered by a reservoir, by a dam that was built, the Zipingu Dam project, constructed a few hundred metres from the known fault line. That's highly contested, mainly by Chinese authorities and Chinese scientists. The latest article has been published by Chinese scientists entitled Evidence that the 2008 Earthquake Could Not Have Been Induced by the Zipingu Reservoir. The title, I think, speaks for itself. Geologists from everywhere else believe it's probably triggered by this reservoir. 68,000 people killed. And the summary of their article concludes that the cause is some unknown tectonic change. I won't go into all the statistics of the water that's filled this reservoir, but But it's pretty well established that non-tectonic reasons, man-made reasons, can cause earthquakes. So that's a problem, I'd say. The converse, but closely related problem, almost there, is the problem of natural hazards causing man-made problems. And the Fukushima comes to mind here. Earthquake with a magnitude of 9, fourth largest seismic event ever recorded, and obviously the consequences with the nuclear power plants, two nuclear power plants in Japan on the coastal region are pretty catastrophic. That's on our list of kinds of accidents. It's an industrial accident. Nuclear accidents are probably amongst the worst. They're certainly amongst the ones that cause the most panic and fear in the population, without going into the arguments, that they're very emotive. It's built in an area that's on the seismic risk map, but the defences simply weren't adequate. I'll stop there.
Thanks so much indeed, Nigel. Do we have a couple of questions for Nigel before we leap into the third? Well, as I guess I have a devil's advocate question. In terms of, if we look at nature society discourse research, there was one argument, there's no such thing as a natural hazard, natural events. So a hurricane on say, an island is actually a very positive. It's part of the hydrological society cycle. It provides water, it allows that, should we say, the biosphere of that island really to exist. Similarly, an earthquake might seem a wholly positive generative process of how the Earth itself is transforming. So in terms of, is it a possibility to say there's no such thing as a natural hazard? There are hazards to humans.
Yeah.
Sometimes those hazards are made by humans. But overall, nature is a biophysical...
So the primacy of nature argument is a good argument, and it's actually... It's possibly right, but if you're living in a given built environment that's affected by that hazard, you will not find it acceptable, and you may hope your government or you have participated in preventative measures. So the problem is that we there's also a counter-argument. I mean, we're part of that. We're part of nature as much as anything else. So the built environment arguably is natural. We are part of nature and built this environment. But every built environment sits in a natural environment and is subject to the long cycle of things that happen in its own natural environment. So I definitely wouldn't disagree with that, but it's the age-old thing. In the general case, what you said is right. For the individuals concerned, a government wants, and indeed that community, will want to take whatever measures they can to protect themselves.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I've spent the last 10 years working with technology companies as a management consultant, and my mother keeps trying to look proud of me, trying to figure out what I do for a living. But now that I was able to tell her I'm speaking at Oxford, I can see the true gleam in her eye. So it's such an honor to be here. I've worked with technology teams for several decades now. My original industry background was at Apple and Microsoft, and then I did a wave of Web 1.0 internet startups. And then I started this consulting practice working with technology teams to accelerate product development and work with them on organizational change. And I spent a program at the Said School coming over several times over last year on organizational leadership, and one of my professors took a shine to me and encouraged me to pursue doctoral work, and that is what has brought me here today, and I'm so pleased to be working with Professor Mickey and my supervisor, Dr. Stokes, is in the audience, and Professor Dobson at the business school. I want to explore a bit about my perspective on how project teams in technology environments and new product development have to deal with risks. So it really all starts with this curve. This curve's been around for a while. And like all good x-axes, it's time, and particularly I want to talk about project time, where projects are something with a beginning, an end, and a measurable goal. And the y-axis here is the cost of making a change. So over the duration of the project, it is more expensive in subsequent phases of new product development to have to institute a change. And when I ask technology teams, well, where do you find many programs, particularly those that are having difficulty making changes? Well, they start populating out here. And even more out there. These are the ones, the projects that everyone remembers. And of course, one of my favorites is examples is this. This is the Hubble telescope, right? It's much more expensive to fix a lens while it's in orbit than when it was back on the ground before it was launched. And one of my other favorites is the Mars Climate Observer. This was where the Pasadena team was calibrating in metric units, and the Texas team was calibrating in English units, and they figured it out while trying to go into orbit around Mars, right? So apparently like 100,000 kilometers an hour does not equal 100,000 miles an hour, and the poor Mars Observer kept going past Mars, right? These are what we call the do-over projects. So, the whole thing that makes talking about risks interesting is simply if you can leverage this curve. So, pay me out there. I'm going to be acknowledged for, you know, being a diehard American, you know, to changing my units for this discussion. So, what if we spend some money here? And that is really what risk mitigation looks like. Is that pay me later or pay me here? And all of this, of course, mitigated by probabilities of various and impacts and whatnot. So in this world, what you're looking to do is fail often and early. And that's really the core best practice of trying to complete, well, any activity, whether it's planning your next birthday party, let alone getting a new product development off. How can we increase learning? You want to cause lots of failures and then just reduce a few that you have to deal with out there. And this has both linear effects and wins on how teams, you know, they actually make schedules, but you get huge non-linear wins. Because if you are doing all sorts of things, your product development, and often these are, you know, betting the company type activities for smaller companies, you know, completely fail and you can't recover. If you are more predictably investing resources here to uncover and play this game, then you have much more, you're much more likely to have the bandwidth to deal with the occasional big screw up that comes at the end. So it fundamentally shapes the rhythm of companies, not just the success of a given project or a given team. So, you know, you show this to technology teams and everyone nods in violent agreement, and then we wind up with the classic situation of, well, you know, what you know has little to do with what you do. You know, that's kind of the nature of human beings, right? If it did, then we'd all be eating more healthy, and we'd be at the gym more, and no one would be left in the world smoking, right? And the joke is that the next piece of knowledge is probably not what would make the difference. You know, reading one more Surgeon General's or Minister of Health report is probably not what would cause the change of behavior around smoking. So what is it that gets in the way of action? And this is a very interesting question, both in practice and academia, and something that I'm very interested in my work. And, you know, it's really all expressed in this wonderful illustration, which some of you might remember from the poster for this talk. Okay, so if you were driving a car and you were blindfolded, what's the first thing you might do? You know, remove the blindfold? You know, what if you didn't realize you were wearing a blindfold? That issue is actually the scariest and contains the key seeds that cause difficulty in risky product development. It's that you don't, it's the volatility on what your volatilities are. It's the fact that you don't know what the issues are. This is one of my favorite illustrations. It came from a magazine that on the economic disaster of several years ago. And this is the picture, right? This is a bird and the worm, you know, or that's what you think it is. And I thought this was a brilliant discussion of what happened. Okay. So if you're a bird in a world where there's lots of things that look like worms that aren't, what can you do? And that actually is at the core of the type of research that I am looking, that I am interested in doing, and the type of work that I do with companies. All right. It's kind of in this flavor, like why do you have this? People are good at talking about what they know. They can call meetings, they can list all the things they know, we're comfortable at doing that type of thing. We're also reasonably comfortable at talking about things we don't know. Like, you know, when you can name your problem, you say, I will go look that up, I will talk to an expert, sometimes you need a little encouraging, but these are situations that are actionable. You may not be interested in taking action on losing weight, but you know that there is action that is possible. What's in the other category? This is what you know, and this is what you know you don't know. Here we have the things you don't know you don't know. Right, this is a much harder list to generate. You know, this is the we don't even know we have a problem, we don't realize we're wearing a blindfold. And this is kind of the real joke. And access to identifying things that start in the no, we don't know is really one of the most powerful things you can do to create an environment to take action on risk. Okay, these are the things in the blind spot. All right. And one of the things you find is that the things that screw up projects are not the thing everyone's worried about, it's the thing they have the least experience with. And so that immediately creates an opportunity for action. What do you identify what we know, what we're doing that's brand new, and then maybe we can just become smarter at it to even know what we didn't know, right? To know what those problems are. But what happens in practice? Well, there's a lot of this, right? You know, looking around, knowing what, you know, there's a lot of, you know, how do teams talk about risk? Well, they don't. You know, little crickets. How's this project going to screw up? Well, that's not a question you hear a lot. Sometimes you do. And actually, where you do, you often are in an environment that is better at new product development than environments that don't. And then I'm going to talk about, this is a very powerful place to create core cultures that facilitate this. The other way that you get is you get lots of talking or screaming or they screwed up, they don't know what they're doing, all that wonderful stuff that human beings love to do. And a matter of fact, when I survey teams around this, you hear all this wonderful language. Well, what about risk? Well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's not my job. They'll never change. No one wants to hear it. Risks are all surprises. They'll take it as criticism. And I'm doing everything I can anyway. You know, has anyone heard that recently on any projects? You know, has anyone said that, right? And this is the you know, part of the normal discourse, and it's not a high-tech problem, it's a human being problem, okay? So, you know, in the face of our humanity, what can we do to increase the likelihood that we uncover risks? Well, this is kind of my inquiry. But how can the use of language, both the form of the conversations, the nature of them, the ritualization of language around its risk and commitment? And this is, I've been doing a lot of this in practice, but I now have the opportunity to more systematically review this academically. And this is what my DACRA work is about. And of course, I'm building on these are my favorite giants of the week, right? I'm only a term into this, so I'm still learning what I don't know, and who I really need to be reading, but you know, the issues of sense-making, Pfeffer and Sutton are two of my favorites at Stanford, complexity theory, Eisenhart, Pascal, of course, the great Amos Tversky, who actually was one of my advisors at Stanford, happy to pay homage to him. The areas of decision analysis, Ron Howard, also one of mine. And then we got the classics of little Schopenhauer, Wittgenstein, Donald Sullivan, LBS in promise-based management, I think has done a lot of interesting work in this. And then the role of language and trust in organizational change is something that I'm looking at. And what has turned me from a social psychologist to a sociologist, of course, in addition to Dr. Ventresca at Oxford, is Clifford Geertz and his work in thick description ethnography. And I think that this has inspired me to do the specific type of dissertation work that I've begun to explore. All right. Okay. So I want to talk about a particular academic research that I'm currently looking at. So this is trust, right? And then we have reward. And there's a question of what's the role of trust, the ability to be vulnerable of teams, i.e. let's say to talk about risks, to talk about why we would fail. And what some research has identified is that trust and project performance are related, but through commitment on the level of the project. So if you can create trust, you increase the level of project team commitment that then has a correlation with increased project results. And this is an area that I am currently exploring. Now, one of the things that I want to bring into this is the work, well, in this case, is Sullivan Spinoza around reliability. That there's a relationship between making promises, keeping them, increasing trust, with trust being a well-established and well-studied area in organizations, which leads to increased commitment, which then creates more promises, and that there is a feedback mechanism that if you can jumpstart and prime, okay, may have a particular correlation with project team result in risky environments. And this is the kind of work that I want to more systematically study. All right, and this is, you know, my thing. I think this is central to the concept of making interesting promises that create trust and inness. So discussions of risk are intimately tied with discussions of commitment. All right, so, if we look at kind of creating this culture, right, this environment that encourages the identification of where we're wearing blindfolds, right, the identification of where we can uncover what we don't know. So we have some basic dynamics of culture, that things that drive culture, and this is pretty much derivative of classic organizational culture, Shine being, you know, of course, one of the greats in that. What I'm looking to explore is inserting language into this game of what drives culture. Okay, who knows, maybe one day there'll be something like that. Okay, now, I don't just want to leave you with a question. I figured I'd leave you with, if you're looking at how to, prescriptively, is there something you can do tomorrow, assuming you've got a team and you want to identify risks? So a couple things that I've observed, and of course that I work with teams on, that I'm looking to more richly develop the academic study of, is get teams that are required to talk about risk. Like every week, it's not a question, does anyone have a risk? It's, what are your risks? What are your top risks? You know, that's what they do for a living. And, you know, we have a joke, you know, I'll just map it because of the conversations, that if a project's doing really, really well, then you'll hear about the earthquake risk, which is, you know, we have nothing more to worry about except, well, I do a lot of work in Silicon Valley, right? Well, we're located on three faults and there may be an earthquake. Okay, you should, if that's what you're hearing from your cross-functional empowered team that is being creating a culture of transparency around risks, then there may be some data that you're ahead of the game. Okay? If you're still hearing about we have no person to test the new hardware system, you know, you don't quite have that luxury. Okay. It was mentioned in Nigel's talk, you know, that there's the anticipation. A risk is an anticipation of a bad outcome, which actually is rooted into a belief about the present. So if you're, the reason why you're worried that you may not test your product is we have no test engineers. Encourage people to uncollapse their language and talk about what are they concerned. I may be concerned I may get into a car accident, but my existing fact is my tires are balding. It has a dynamic about reducing drama and creates an increased accessibility to action. Okay. And the point of talking about risks is so we can take action. We can actually, if we move things from the don't know we don't know into the know we don't know, then at least we can decide where to put our money. If we don't even know that's an issue, then we can't even have that conversation. And when teams, well, at first are scared to death about talking about risks, once they see that it creates an opportunity for action, okay, then it becomes a self-fulfilling organizational cultural dynamic. Okay, and this is what I'm looking to further explore. All right. So where does it leave me, you know, as I leave here? Well, you know, I have aspirations to be an ethnographer. There's a lot of quantitative work, but I think, having spent times with dozens and dozens of technology teams, I think there's an opportunity to tell their stories as they see it around risk and around commitment. And this is, you know, one of my most favorite, most inspiring pieces of work was Tracy Kidder's Soul of a New Machine. And it's a wonderful story of in the 70s, the creation of the Data General Eagle mini computer. And I think there's an opportunity to tell more stories from academic and more academically rigorous perspective. And I look forward to doing that. And recording literally what is the language, because that's an opportunity to re-engineer. You know, what are they saying and what could they be saying? Literally, what's the conversation? Because that's as human beings, that's one of the biggest things we do. We talk to each other. How does it correlate to performance, and of course, how and why? Thank you very much.
Thanks very much indeed, Adam. That was great. I took on board, I have to make more mistakes more often to succeed. That's brilliant. To get cracking. Any questions for Adam? And then there'll be time for questions for all three presenters.
Where you're talking about communication, which seems to be underlying the problem, and modern software teams where they may not be co-located.
Right.
What's your...
Well, so there's a whole dynamic of virtual teams and multi-geography teams, and the interesting thing is, but also with that, we have many more mediums, hyper-connectivity and ways to communicate, and you know, when I put on my sociology hat, it's like we have, human beings have plenty of ways to not talk to each other with all the additional Twitters and social networks that we have. And so what it's about is creating a commitment to have quality conversations. Then simply how you manage that becomes a means. And, you know, teams that operate virtually, the core dynamics, if they have a commitment for a high level of high bandwidth effective communication, then they find ways to make it work. And teams that don't have that commitment, despite all the video conferencing and other mechanisms they may have, will not have that level of conversation. So that's really taking it a step back and make sure that that's, you know, this is how we operate our organizations, and then we can solve the rest just like you would solve any other things. And obviously, it does create some interesting logistical investments, a need for logistical investments, and a commitment to make that happen. Getting back to Professor Mickey's observation about innovative teams that make investments in their teams, which it's wholly consistent with my perspective. And if you want people to talk, you've got to give them time to talk and places to talk virtually across time zones, across geographies.
Do you have a question?
Yeah. So in your talk, I noticed, so the previous talk benefited a lot from hindsight analysis of catastrophes.
Mm.
And when you draw this famous Donald Rumsfeld matrix, and you talk now about language and getting people to talk about what the beliefs about the present are so you can extrapolate it to the future. It almost sounds like if you take it to an organizational level that you get people to actually discover what they really know and what they're not aware of.
Yes.
And in that sense, and you also mentioned Amos Tversky, who talks a lot about, or Kahneman, who talk a lot about, this risk come actually from that we all, in our bubble, we all take the inside view. We're not taking the outside view. So how is it really how can language really help tearing people out of their system and their system of thinking to see these things?
Excellent. And this is a big issue, right? You know, I don't want to pretend to have the definitive answer, but two places that I look is, first, a formalization of language. There are particular, I would argue, that certain ways to communicate risk, I sort of implicitly alluded to it, like this concept of talking about the existing fact as well as your concern about the future, that as a structure, you know, people get coached in that, and they actually take on, hey, this is, how do I more effectively communicate a risk or my perception of the universe? And I find this works incredibly powerfully cross-culturally as well. The other thing, the place to look is complexity theory, and complex adaptive teams. That if you put well-meaning, committed folks and let them bump into each other, you will get emergent, complicated systems and ways to play each other, play with each other, and it takes on its whole life of its a whole life of its own. And what it takes is what are your initial conditions? So how are you setting? How do you create a team and an environment such that when you then, you're not micromanaging every minute of their life, but that they will interact with each other in a more useful way more often than if you started them with a different set of initial conditions.
Thanks.
Sounds very obvious and makes it sound very simple. Chris Algeris, 25 years ago, did a study of this sort, working with teams, trying to change the way they thought, and found it was incredibly difficult to get them out of their modes of thinking. And I might go back to that word.
Yes, please. I'm in the middle of the very, very start of my literature search. Please, if any of you have a recommendation, I would be very, let me crowdsource my literature review. Please steer me in directions. I would love to look at that. One thing that you have in modern society is the duration of projects and the duration of product life cycles are so much shorter that you have an opportunity for much more rapid learning, and so the world, everything is pressuring individuals to become more adaptive, just to be able to make their mortgages, and there's nothing like mapping into personal incentives. The life of guaranteed lifetime employment is less of a reality, and so people get a little more excited about that, particularly when you show them how they can win. And when you can do that in a shorter time frame, it increases their interest.
I'll give you the reference.
Yes, please. We'll meet offline. I'll get it to you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Or you can whisper it to my doctoral supervisor over there.
And thank you. Are there any questions to Adam, but also to Jonathan or Nigel?
I was just wondering how we'd put the three sessions together, really. Because we started off with a market analysis and then another analysis talking about catastrophic risk, and then the difficulties that we have with people and teams. And there's definitely a link between three. But is it coincidental that you've sort of come up with these three themes? Or is there something that we should round off the session with in terms of a general hypothesis?
Well, I suppose it's an organising seminar. So the random selection that volunteers to who are speaking. So
I do think they're connected, by the way.
It's interesting there. But I think, you know, I was thinking. I sort of had a colleague who said, well, I'm sorry, I'll let the speakers answer properly, but I was talking to a colleague who knows about risk, and I said, you know, well, what, give us some sort of background and stuff. And I was told, what we said, well, basically everything's risk. And I thought, great, that's helpful. an author, Jeanette Winterson, who one of my favourite authors, and she's also an entrepreneur, and I was just thinking of how to bring these three together. And actually, all sort of notion of value is of interest. And Jeanette Winterson wrote... She wrote, what you risk reveals what you value. And in some ways, when Jonathan was talking about the notion of entrepreneurship and innovation, there's that element of value-laden society, how risk fits into that. So maybe some element of risk and value are lurking across the three of them. You know, valuing your shelter, valuing your built environment, valuing your economic, social, as well as physical environment. But I'll probably let the experts answer with far more lucidity. So if Jonathan or...
Well, one thing I'd say is maybe the importance of not only interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary discussion, but also of institutions and culture across these questions. And that's somewhere where economists, I think, are usually particularly guilty at ignoring sort of institutions and culture. So even the point about entrepreneurship, actually, is often economists often presented as completely devoid of all the institutions and culture that actually tend to make... company successful. I wish I had more time to give me the opportunity to tell my favourite joke, which is George Bush's criticism of the French economy when he said that probably the French economy is the French of no word for an entrepreneur.
Right, follow that.
I didn't know I'd volunteered, but you said your difficulty was getting volunteers.
Yeah,
I volunteered.
Like you volunteered. Yeah, that was a technical voluntary. Yeah.
But I think they are closely related, but they can be related. There's the interdisciplinary point. My thoughts about these disasters and global catastrophic risk, particularly, is post-disciplinary, maybe. People involved in a very wide range of disciplines. But all of the underlying decisions about how you tackle, address, or plan for a disaster are bound up in many ways with market risk, with the size of government, the role of government, which is all sort of going on in the economic side of it. And if you come down to the smallest level, if you want to get a plan together of the kind I was describing, you're going to have to create a team, and many of the points that Adam was talking about, not in terms of risks of product failure, but of how teams communicate and get to the end result successfully, are all in that team. So that's a slightly disingenuous way to link them together.
Oh, the one thing I would say is, in listening to my colleagues, was the incentive system. You know, the measures of the game determine it. I mean, I have the luxury, frankly, of working for for-profit innovation companies. I don't know how to do my work for the government, because I think one of the things that you're identifying is you get some interesting incentives there, as you certainly get in the private industry, as was explained. You know, short-term profit. You know, sacrificing employees on the altar of next quarter's EBITDA. These are very real dynamics, and they incent the types of conversations. They provide the context, you know, one of the most decisive contexts for the types of conversations that take place in organizations.
I think one of the interesting things that hadn't come through, in terms of the seminars, are meant really to bring all aspects together. So one of the practical aspects of risk that I thought might come through is actually doing research. I work on urban environments, and so I'm never really at risk, but clearly it's a risk-filled environment for the interviewees and those working, living in there. But in terms of risk, I think maybe later on, the new graduate school is setting up a series of research method workshops. So I know Adrian and Christine are organising those. But that element of risk within doing research, a practice of research, is something that we haven't covered today. But I think in terms of, you know, the practice of doing stuff, risk is very interesting. It's not just filling a form, but it's also the ethical risks researchers take, but also the risks that interviewees take as well in getting engaged in research. So that's probably something, and maybe that practical aspect of research will feed in more into later discussions around gender and maybe revolution. I don't know whether Tom was causal in Nicaragua. You maybe were not causal, but you were there at the time. But those practical aspects as well as theoretical aspects of the topics, I think, were something that we can bring in.
Just for me, it was I was making big connections between the first and second. I thought Jonathan was going to go on to talk, well, organisational structure, you know, capitalism, and putting industries like the nuclear industry in privatising, for instance, management of the nuclear legacy in the UK. It's currently going on, very little debate about it. And potential for this catastrophic risk, which you're putting into the hands of the market sector. So, you know, there's a big connection there, and obviously with the people interface. For instance, you know, technologists, are you talking to technologists? Are they having a sufficient voice in these big decisions that are being taken place at the moment? So I think there's an awful lot of connection between the three sessions there.
Well, thanks very much. Are there any more questions? I'd just like to thank you all for attending today. I mean, the idea is to show something, what the intellectual engagement within the college for members of the department and out with. But it's also a social occasion. So we'll have a wine drinks reception in the common room, and then there is a dinner in the Ackman room. So we'll be proceeding to the common room now. But I'd like to especially thank Liz Sanders at the back, who's done all the organisation, has brought these seminars together. Thanks very much, Liz. And also Paul for, I think, working beyond hours to make us live on the web, or live later on the web. So thank you very much, Steve. And I'd also like to thank our three speakers, Jonathan, Nigel and Adam, for really kicking off the Rooley House Research Series. And do come to the next Revolutionary Research Seminar in February. So thank you very much indeed. And I think Liz will lead the way to the drinks reception. So thanks so much indeed to the speakers.